Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I do come to you from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group is the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and when our group was started, you had one town, you had one meeting. And that's the way it was. And, of course, a couple of resentments and a few coffee pots, and now we got 15 meetings and 50, or 15 groups and 50 some meetings. So that's the way we grow in AA. I want to thank Al for inviting me to be here this evening. I think it's very important that you know who is responsible for my being here. Al's right over here. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 2.5 hours that we're together, you take that up with Al, because he's the one that invited me. Now, if I happen to say something that you approve of, well, by all means, see me after the meeting, because I do enjoy those attaboys. And my mom's 94 years old, and she was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and I tell you that not because it has anything to do with me being an alcoholic, but my mom knows what an alcoholic is. And I called my mom this afternoon just to check in. My sister's up visiting with her, and I told her, reminded her where I was, and she said, "You're down there talking to another one of those AA things, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." And she said, "Well, you make sure you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic." And you see, my mom, she knows what an alcoholic is. It's about time I started listening to my mom, quite frankly. She may very well be right. I could have overreacted to this whole thing. And I have attended I've attended all of the sessions here, and I've heard Bob read that same list of lame announcements at each session. And personally, I do not like to be told what to do, and I noticed that some of you don't either. And usually I just do the opposite. So, I mean, if you're here this evening and you got a cell phone with you, turn that puppy on. And especially if you're anticipating a liver transplant. But if you wouldn't mind, put it on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us, okay? I began to drink when I was, 14 years old, more or less, and I am sure alcohol did for me exactly what it did for you once I had enough on board where I could feel the effect produced by alcohol. It permitted me to do stuff that I could never do, not drinking. It allowed me to fit in. It just allowed life to become a lot easier. I knew immediately why my dad drank. It was a shame he couldn't hold his alcohol the way I could, but I understood why he drank. And obviously when you're 14 years old, you can't drink every day, but you can certainly be planning on drinking. You can do all the thinking that goes into drinking. You can get together the money and the guys and how we're going to get it and where we're going to get it and how much we're going to get and what happens if we run out and where are we going to go with it. I mean, there's a lot that goes into thinking about drinking when you're 14 or 15. And I used to say that drinking never really affected me or affected my life while I was drinking, but in those days. But I do have to tell you that I spent 5 years in high school. I used to think it was because of a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but it wasn't. It was the booze, and I know that now. I did not know that then. I just thought it was them. And you know who they are. You've had them in your life. They've always been doing it to us, and they were doing it to me. But I got out of high school, and I went to the community college. And one summer, good friend of mine and I decided to take a road trip, go to California. And so we got 12 cases of beer and put it in the back of my car. We each packed an overnight bag, and we had everything you needed for a trip to California. I quit my job. I had a pocket full of money. We had that 12 cases of beer. And the day before we were to go, his dad told him he could not go. And I was crushed. And I wasn't going to drive to California by myself. Now, Bill was a stand-up guy, and so he gave me his half interest in those 12 cases of beer. And many of you know, or most of you know, I guess, is the easternmost border of the state of Maryland is on the Atlantic Ocean. And we have a resort community there called Ocean City. And so I took those 12 cases of beer and I went down to Ocean City. And I spent a month down there living as a bum. I didn't have a job. I stayed in the basement of hotels where I knew people who were desk clerks and bellhops. I ate leftover restaurant food at restaurants where I knew waiters and waitresses, you know, an uneaten crab cake, half a lobster tail. I didn't have to pay anything for room. I didn't have to pay anything for board. I had those 12 cases of beer to drink, had that pocket full of money, and I had a great time in Ocean City. I had a marvelous time in Ocean City. So much so that I decided I wanted to work in Ocean City the following year. But I'm a keen observer of my surroundings, and it was apparent to me that if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, over the course of a summer, there was a very good chance of getting arrested. I mean, it didn't make any difference if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a waiter or a waitress, a bartender, a bellhop. It didn't make any difference if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted. You very well might get arrested. But I noticed there was a group of people who drank like I drank and acted like I acted when drinking, and they were not getting arrested. And these were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. And the first summer I worked in Ocean City as a police officer, they gave me a boardwalk beat. They gave me 9th Street. If you know anything about Ocean City, you know that's a happening place. And I'd been working maybe a week when it became apparent that I possessed a singularly unique talent, I think. I can spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And you know, I'd pick out my target of opportunity. I'd approach them, determine that indeed they were underage, ask what they had in the cooler. They'd tell me they had some Coca-Cola, a little Tupperware thing full of tuna fish, half a loaf of bread. Would you mind opening the cooler? They'd lift the lid. There, a nice even row across the top of the crushed ice, be the Coca-Cola. Little Tupperware thing over in the corner, half a loaf of bread. I'd reach way down into the bottom of that cooler, and invariably, I'd come up with a Budweiser. And if you were that underage drinker, your life, as you've known it, has just ended. I know, you thought you were going to go to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. You go into the Ocean City Jail, and when that college that you got admitted to finds out that you've been in the Ocean City Jail, they're not going to let you in. Maybe you were thinking about a career in the United States military, but that ain't happening. The United States military really doesn't need people like you who've been in the Ocean City Jail. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call your mom and dad back in Baltimore at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to tell them that you have been locked up in the Ocean City Jail. What's that? You want to offer an alternative? A compromise, you say. Well, what did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer? Well, it's certainly worthy of consideration, but you do understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm taking the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that? All right. Well, you got to promise me that you will never, ever do anything remotely like this again in Ocean City. You promise me? You're free to go. Now, it's mighty difficult to walk a boardwalk beat dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and sergeant, and they'd come with their squad car as I accumulated the coolers, and they'd put them in the trunk, and I would meet them at the end of every shift. And if I'd gotten any whiskey or any wine, I'd give it to my lieutenant and sergeant, and I'd take the cooler and the beer and the tuna fish and the Coca-Cola. I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day, didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. And that's my idea of a good summer. So, Al, I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can see it or I pay any attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer. So I went back for a second summer, and that second summer they gave me a squad car. Lights and siren. Big old Ford Crown Victoria. You ever look at the trunks of one of those things? You can get four bodies or five coolers in the trunk of one of those cars. And this expanded my territory, and while I really didn't need my sergeant and my lieutenant like I had the previous year, they maintained a keen interest in my activities, and at the end of every shift, I met them down at the police department, and I'd give them the whiskey and the wine, and I'd take the cooler and the beer. And, you know, if you were an acquaintance or a friend of mine, or a friend of a friend of mine, and you came down to Ocean City that summer, and you needed a cooler, I'm your guy. I mean, I got coolers stacked up to the ceiling of my back porch. And I got a no-return policy. Just come, pick out the cooler you want, and just don't get arrested. And had a good summer that summer, drank every day, didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. So I thought I was on a roll. So I went back for a third summer. Now, keep in mind that I'm a college kid. I mean, I had finished my community college, and I'd gone on down to College Park to the University of Maryland. But like a lot of college kids, I got no idea what it is I want to do with my life. I'm not even sure why I am in college. I know it's a student deferment, and they did have a shooting war going on, and it was very helpful to be in college. But I just didn't know what I was going to do when this college thing ended. So I'm down in Ocean City. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I stop a car for, I can stop a guy for drunk driving. I get him out of the car. He is obviously drunk. I am writing him up, and he says to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county that you're standing in right now." I don't know what a state's attorney is either. I've never heard the term state's attorney. I've never seen a state's attorney. I got no idea what a state's attorney does. So I said, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." And he signed the ticket, and they had a guy with him who appeared to be sober. So I let him drive the car, and they went on their way. And I finished off my shift at 8 o'clock. I pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department. And there, to meet me, as I got out of my cruiser, was the chief of police. And he said to me, "Bring that uniform citation book with you and come up to my office." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me during the entire summer. Now, I thought this was a good thing because it was clear to me I was about to get commended for a job well done. A long overdue commendation, I might add. So I went up to his office, and as I went in, walked into his office, much to my surprise, seated on the couch right inside the door on the right was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the chief says, "Give me that book." I gave him the ticket book. He opened it to the ticket. He handed it to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch took out a pen, and he wrote across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signed his name. It was at that moment that I decided that I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of those state's attorneys, I definitely wanted to be one of them. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic charges with a stroke of a pen was going to be coming mighty handy. So I went to law school. I had met my wife while at the University of Maryland in College Park. We had gotten married. And when I graduated law school, we went back to Hagerstown, which was my hometown. And maybe I'd been practicing law 6 or 7 weeks. And I became aware that the state's attorney in Washington County was looking for an assistant state's attorney. So I went right over. Here I am. Answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start? Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. Good luck with that liver transplant. I'm easily distracted and I lose my place, so I'm Jack. I'm an alcoholic. Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. You may have experienced some of this in your own life. I have a hearing problem, and many things that I thought I've heard said were never said. I have a perception problem. Things that I thought I saw happen never happened. So this is what I thought I heard them say. What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never made an opening statement or a closing argument. You've never examined or cross-examined a witness. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard them say. Now, in truth, I believe they said something to the effect that the position has been filled. But I heard what I heard. And it may surprise you to know that I'm very sensitive. And I don't suffer well. And I was hurt. And I was angered. And I left that office that day with what I now know to be a resentment. And an alcoholic with a resentment can do quite a lot. And we elect our prosecutors in Maryland. So I went and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. Now, when you get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And with that badge comes a badge case. And in that badge case, there is a clear, glassine window that you put your driver's license behind. And so when they pull you over, and they ask to see your license and registration, you exhibit that badge case to them. They never look at the driver's license. They look at the badge. Oh, the badge officer, Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. No, sir. I am not upset that you stopped me. I fully understand you're just doing your job. I may have had 4 or 5. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Really don't have that far to go. No, sir, just a few miles down the road. I think I can stay on my side of the road, sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, officer. I very much appreciate the professional courtesy that you're extending to me, and you have a nice night also. Now, some of you may be gaining a little insight into why I've never been arrested or had an alcohol-related offense. But it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was supposed to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, I was going to get appointed state's attorney. But sometimes, it may happen here in Virginia or from where you're from, our local state senator stuck his nose in where it didn't belong, screwed the whole thing up, and somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. And I was very disappointed for my friend. But I was some kind of upset that I didn't get appointed state's attorney. That may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And one night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, it was determined that really something ought to be done with that state senator. We had to teach him a lesson. Somebody ought to run against him in the next election. Somebody ought to challenge him in the primary. We need to find a volunteer. So I ran for the state senate. Now, I did not know that the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee, abandon his wife and children, and move to Florida, but he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate, and it says state senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going on, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads out. And they come up alongside of you on the interstate, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Aye, Senator. Aye, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have members of the Maryland State Police tied up alongside of the highway with members of the General Assembly when they could be off arresting real crooks. Now, that guy that got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like the job. So he quit. And I went over to see the governor. I wanted the governor to appoint my guy, the state's attorney, appoint him circuit court judge. And the governor said there was too much adverse publicity associated with that last appointment up in Hagerstown, and that he would not and could not appoint my guy circuit court judge. However, if I'd like to be circuit court judge, he'd appoint me. Well, it's a 15-year term in Maryland, and we only had two in our community, so I became circuit court judge. Scary idea, isn't it, Bob? Yeah, I know. I'm drinking alcoholically all through this. I love to drink. I love everything about drinking. I was a barroom drinker. I love neon lights. I love the way they reflect into the back bar mirror. I love the way they hit the back bar mirror and then reflect through the various shapes of the various bottles. I like the colors of the liquids in the bottles. The ambers, the darks, the yellows, the greens, the clears. I love the ambiance of barroom drinking. I love the sawdust on the floor. I love the peanut shells. I love the smell of stale beer and urine. I love it all. I love the glassware. I love the glassware of drinking, the stemware, the tall, thin, frosted Tom Collins glass, which they put them away now for the season. They won't be back out till the spring. But I love that, and I love the little squat, old-fashioned glasses and the stemware, the fluted martini glass. I mean, at one time, I had a love affair with a gin martini. I admit to that. Where else can you get olives like that? Really, I've never seen olives like that except in a gin martini. But I had this really bad gin experience, and to this day it is difficult for me to go into a pine forest. My drink of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label on crushed ice with a twist of lemon. I mean, that was my favorite. But if you came up to me and you had a brown paper bag and you shoved it at me and said, "Here, Jack, take a pull on this," I wouldn't ask you what's in that bag. You wouldn't have offered it to me if it wasn't good. So, good stuff.
Oh, man. You know how when you have people over to the house and I don't know, playing cards or watching a ball game, and then they leave and there's a bunch of cans sitting around and you got to clean up, and you clean it, picking up the cans, and, well, this has got a little something in it. And, oh, oh, my, what was that? Cigarette butt. You got it. Yeah. Well, I know there's cigarette butt drinkers in here. I see your heads moving. Oh, yeah. My people. It was April the 7th of 1982, and a local attorney and I had decided we were going to go out and get drunk. We told my wife that we were going out to dinner. But this was not one of those occasions when I allowed myself to be negligently overserved. Our purpose was to go out and to get knee-walking, snot-flying drunk, and we did. And we ended up in a local honky-tonk, and had I known that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, I assure you, I would have ordered something else. And if I'd have had even a remote idea that I was going to be invited to come here to Virginia Beach and talk to you fine folks about my last drink of beverage alcohol, I would have definitely ordered something else. Because as you're about to hear, there is a considerable amount of embarrassment and a degree of shame associated with what I am required to tell you. And that is that my last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. How do you think I feel, Bob? Yes. Well, I can tell by the expression on some of your faces that you have no idea what Tia Maria is. And you can trust me on this. You don't need to know. And if you're thinking about going back out, do not go back out for Tia Maria, because you're going to be one disappointed guy or gal. It's just is not worth. Stay here. I mean, if you're here, stay here. Why not stay here? You know, it's interesting. In all of my activity and involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, not a single thing has harmed me here. Any pain that I've ever experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a direct result of my resistance to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, why not stay here? I mean, you're here. Why not stay here? Out there, we die. We die out there. And in here, we get to live a second life in the same lifetime. What a good deal that is. So, my wife is a school teacher. And I guess the school, she's an elementary school teacher. And my guess is that the elementary school children in our community are not much different than the elementary school children in your community. Those little elementary school kids are just germ encrusted. I mean, they got germs all over them. And the germs jump off onto the teacher. And then the teacher comes home and the germs jump off of the teacher onto the spouse of the teacher. And the next morning, I got up, I had flu. Those pesky little kids had done it to me again. But we go to work. We do not miss work. I mean, if I were to miss work, somebody might suggest that my drinking was interfering with my work. So I went to work. And the next day was Good Friday, so the courthouse was closed. And I still had the flu, but by Friday, I had developed that upset stomach thing that generally accompanies flu. And by Saturday, my conditioning was worsening. And along with that upset stomach thing, I now had that lower tract distress. And if you got that lower tract distress combined with that upset stomach thing, I mean, that'll hone your decision-making down to a fine edge. And I didn't know whether to sit or kneel or kneel or sit. And on at least one occasion that weekend, I made the wrong decision. Now, if my wife was here, you could talk to her about that. But she's not. And I'll go ahead. Easter Sunday, I still had flu. On Monday, they put me in the hospital. I was dehydrated from all that kneeling and sitting that I had been doing. And that night, my abdomen became distended. They did an emergency laparotomy on me. They found my abdomen to be full of peritonitis, gangrene. While they were trying to clean that up, my kidneys quit. My liver was enlarged and out of whack. My pancreas was digesting itself. And my respiratory system quit. And things weren't looking good for the home team. And I spent 3 weeks in intensive care at Hagerstown Hospital, and I continued to deteriorate. And they told my wife they were going to send me down to Baltimore to Johns Hopkins. They told my wife they were sending me there to die. They didn't think that anything could be done to improve my situation, but if they could, maybe Hopkins could do it. I'm glad they didn't tell me that. I would have found that discouraging. Went down to Hopkins. They did everything down there but hang me by my thumbs for 2 weeks. My belly button birthday is May the 14th. And on May the 13th, these two learned physicians who were in charge of my case came into my room. And before they could get a word out of their mouths, I told them that I couldn't take it anymore. They got me off the respirator, but everything else was still going south. And I said, I need a day of rest. And they said, well, that's why we're here, Judge. We presented your case to the internal medicine department. We don't know what's wrong with you. We can't get a majority vote. We've done all that we know to do. And so tomorrow you are going to get a day of rest. And so I turned 40 in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. 2 weeks later, on May the 28th, I was discharged from the Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function returned. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. My liver went back to within normal limits. But when you're in a hospital for 7 weeks like that, they like to talk to you before they send you home. They like to tell you the do's and don'ts so you won't come back. But if you got an undiagnosed illness, they don't really know what to tell you. Now, quite frankly, my position then and my position now is that it's much better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. I mean, that was my position then. That's my position now. And I was almost out of that doctor's office when one of them said, Judge, could we ask you a question? One more question. Sure. Do you drink? What kind of question's that? I'm a lawyer. Well, I used to be a lawyer, now I'm a judge, but when I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients, I had to drink with other lawyers, I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I got to drink with lawyers, and I got to drink with judges. It's a matter of professional obligation. Of course I drink. How much do you drink? Not much. So why do you ask? They said, well, you got these three really delicate organs involved here, and there's nothing that destroys kidneys like alcohol. And we don't know what would happen if you took a drink of alcohol. Then there's the matter of your liver. We don't know if you've got permanent liver damage or not. We won't know for some time. And if you took a drink of alcohol, we don't know what would happen. And then there's your pancreas. And there's nothing destroys the pancreas like alcohol. So we just think you should not drink for a while. How long? A year. Who? A year. Well, I haven't had a drink since April the 7th, and this is May the 28th. I think I might be able to do that. Sure. And they said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I know that there are people in this room who have already discerned the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me because I was getting no credit whatsoever for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. And I want you to know that I fought for those 7 weeks, and an argument broke out between this knuckleheaded judge and these two learned doctors at Johns Hopkins. And the big argument and the big fight was, when would I drink again? And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was that I would not drink until next April the 7th. And if I thought any of the pain, suffering, and misery that I just endured for 7 weeks was in any way associated with drinking, then I could choose not to drink till June the 1st. And with that, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking and not changing. Nobody said anything about alcoholism. Just don't drink. Just don't drink. Well, I think we all know here that if just don't drink worked, Nancy Reagan would have been right. Just say no. How could I have missed it? We quit drinking, we live happily ever after. But our book says, and my experience confirms, you take alcohol away from the alcoholic, I get restless, irritable, and discontented. As a matter of fact, that is a gross understatement in my case. I mean, I'm not drinking, okay? I'm not drinking. And with every passing day of every passing week of every passing month, that's proof positive that I'm not alcoholic, because everybody here knows that alcoholics drink and I'm not drinking, ergo, not alcoholic. Might be a little bit on edge, a little touchy, a little prickly maybe a little quick to react. But you know, if you just mind your own darn business and stop trying to tell me what to do, I think you and I get along a lot better if you just listen to what I had to say and do what I tell you to do, okay? Because there is nothing wrong with me. I am fine. I'm fine, okay? I'm fine. So, Tom, how'd you like to have your DWI in front of me, huh, on Monday morning? Fine. My alcoholic father, on July the 3rd of 1968, was walking past a church in Hagerstown where the pastor put out on the message board on July the 3rd, "Don't buy a fifth on the 3rd for the 4th. My dad went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and he never drank again. And when he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. I carry his 15-year chip with me, along with my token. And I hope in some small way I can repay the large debt, some portion of it, to Alcoholics Anonymous that our family owes for our father's life. He'd lost that 30-year marriage to my mom. He had lost the respect of his children, myself and my younger sister. When she got married, she did not invite our father to the wedding. I gave her away. She was afraid that he would come and be drunk. He came anyway, and he was drunk. He lost a business that he spent 30 years building from scratch. He lost everything. He lost the material things, and he lost the priceless things. He lost his integrity. He lost his self-esteem. He lost his value as a man. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave him back the priceless things. He became a man of integrity. And he was allowed to become the man that God had created him to be. And he had 15 wonderful years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there were two guys in Hagerstown, Ken and Bob, who knew my dad and knew that he had died with 15 years sober. And they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism. And they came to me, and Bob said, "Jack, we have this book in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. And we were thinking maybe you'd like to read it, find out about your dad's illness." Clever guy, that Bob. If he'd have said anything remotely close to, "Jack, we think you should read this so you can find out what's wrong with you," there's nothing wrong with me. We've already established that. But I was interested in learning about my dad's illness, so I read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and no surprise to me, my dad's in there. I mean, my dad was a real alcoholic, as defined by the Big Book, and I was not surprised to find him in there. But what did surprise me in reading that book is I'm in there. That book was written before I was born, and I was astounded that they have recorded on the pages of that book events in my life, but they wrote them down before I was born, and then I experienced them. How could they possibly know so much about me? So I went back to Ken and Bob, and I told them that I was willing to concede that there was a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that I may have contracted a very mild case of alcoholism and that we've caught it just in time. Well, that's all Ken and Bob needed, because they started coming to my chambers, my judge's office, every Friday at noon. And they brought a brown bag lunch with them, and they brought their big books, and I had a lunch and my big book. And we would eat our lunch, and we would pray the Serenity Prayer, and we would read from the big book, and Ken and Bob would explain to me the importance of what we had just read. And then I would explain to them as Jack sees it. And as you can imagine, we had many high-level intellectual discussions in my chambers about the meaning of the big book. And I reminded them, as I tell you now, that while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, I did graduate from the community college in 2 years. And I went down to the University of Maryland in College Park, and I graduated from there in 2 years. And then I went over to the University of Maryland School of Law, where I received my Juris Doctorate, with honors, I might add, at the end of 3 years of study. And Ken said, "Jack, we've got degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them." Said that in my office. I'd not heard that before. I've heard it a lot since I've been in AA, but I'd never heard it up until that time. And you see, Ken and Bob knew that I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and they knew they were willing to risk hurting my feelings. They knew my feelings had been hurt before. They knew I'd get over it. They were willing to risk offending me, because I'd been offended before. I'd get over it. They were willing to risk making me angry, because I've been angry before, and I would get over it. But if something didn't change, and didn't change soon, I was going to die of untreated alcoholism. And they knew that. I didn't know that. But they knew that if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, would make me angry just knowing what it was, knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, even though I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. But just not knowing would make me angry. And they were willing to risk that, because they knew if they were consistent and persistent in presenting the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous to me, that there would come a day, maybe, when I would actually know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And when I found out what it was that they knew that I didn't know, not knowing what it was that they knew that I didn't know, that by that time, I would be okay knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, because I would know what they knew. Because in AA, you know that you know when you know, and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you didn't, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. December 22nd, 1989 was a Friday before Christmas. We couldn't have our big book meeting because the courthouse was closed. I'll tell you this, that when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions. And on each occasion, there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. Now, I think that's pretty conclusive evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those six separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six separations, and we had no idea. So on this occasion, my wife and I were separated. And I had an apartment, and after having lunch with Ken and Bob, I went back to my apartment, and the mailman had brought a package up, a Hickory Farms package. You see them at Christmas time. Somebody sent the judge a sausage or a cheese log, and I thought, well, I'll just go in and open this up, have a little snack, and take some messages off my answering machine. And So I'd gone into my apartment and I was taking the answers off the answering machine, and I'd cut the tape. I found where the box was sealed, and I cut the tape with my ignition key to my car, and I was listening to the answer on the answering machine, and I lifted the lid of the box. Oh! And I got blown back against the wall. And a federal appellate judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed by a bomb sent to his home about 10 days before that. And a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his office about 4 or 5 days before. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew I'd opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I tried to put it out, and I couldn't. And I went out in the hallway, and I pulled the fire alarm, and a neighbor came and said he had a fire extinguisher. And I went back into my apartment and went back to a telephone where I could call 911. And when I went to dial that, when I went to push those buttons, I discovered that part of my right hand had been blown away. And then when I hung up the phone, someone was pulling on my pants, and I looked down on the floor, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I looked at it. I knew I was in serious trouble, and my neighbor came and said he put the fire out and wanted to know if there's anything else he could do, and I asked him to get me a towel, and he did, and I opened my trousers, and I did not have the courage to try to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been injured and put my back against the wall and slid down on the floor. And it was real clear to me that I was dying and I was alone and I was afraid, terribly afraid. And I was powerless, absolutely powerless. And I had no, I was going to die on that floor and never see my wife and never see our 3 children again, and I didn't know what to do. What could I do? And every Friday that Bob and Ken and I had gotten together in my chambers, we had begun every session together with a serenity prayer. And so I reached for the only tool I had. And I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I could not change. The courage to change what I could and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer and I prayed that prayer. And I can't tell you whether it was the 4th, 5th, or 6th time through that prayer, but I can tell you this. God came. God came. I was overcome by a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I had never experienced before in my life, and nor have I experienced it since. And I knew if I died on that floor that afternoon and didn't see my wife and our 3 children again, it'd be okay. It'd be okay. And the police, fire, and rescue burst through the door of my apartment, and both of my eardrums had been blown out, and they were trying to communicate with me, and I stopped praying, and as soon as I did, this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me, and I told them, guys, you do whatever you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I'm doing. And as soon as I went back to the serenity prayer, that sense of peace and well-being came upon me, and they cut all my clothes off of me with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. They put me on a backboard and strapped me on a gurney, and they took me down 3 flights of steps and stuck me in the back of an ambulance, and our local television station was Johnny on the Spot, and they got a picture of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out of the back of that ambulance, and they went around the world on CNN, and I went off to the hospital to surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken. And they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery, and he held my hand, and he prayed for me, and we prayed together, and they sent me up to surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows to stop when passing through flesh, but I can only tell you what they told me, and that is they removed a rather significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And if my femoral artery had been nicked, there'd be a different speaker here tonight for sure. When I came to in that recovery room, seated at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. And let me say, it's good to have a sponsor. It's really good to have a sponsor. I mean, sponsors have a different take on things. They see things differently. I don't know what it is, but if you're here tonight and you're new and you don't have a sponsor, I just implore you, get a sponsor as soon as you can. This room is full of people who are eminently qualified to be your sponsor. We're not asking you to get married. We're just asking you to get a sponsor. Somebody that's been down the path, that knows where the traps are, can help us along, show us what they did. Maybe you're here, maybe you've been here a while, maybe you're used here, maybe you used to have a sponsor, maybe you and your sponsor grew apart, maybe they moved on or passed on, and you're doing that I sponsor myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ism of Alcoholics Anonymous, I sponsor myself. You know, if you're here tonight and you're doing that, I don't mean to be rude or unkind, but you have an idiot for a sponsor. Get a sponsor. Bob's at the foot of my bed and he's smiling. I said, Bob, I see you're smiling. What are you smiling at? And he said, well, Jack, he said, I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed. I said, harmed, Bob? I said, somebody just tried to kill me. He said, oh, yes. He said, I understand that package that you opened contained 4 pipe bombs. He said, 1 pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. 2 pipe bombs is redundant. 3 pipe bombs is a bit around the bend. 4 pipe bombs, Jack, I'd say you've made somebody very angry. He said, man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God. Good to have a sponsor. I'm going to come up with that in a million years. No way. He said, God has spared you for a purpose, Jack. God has work for you to do. I said, really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me to do? He said, Jack, he said, I would not presume to know what God's will for you in that area is. But I know this with a certainty, that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with me or with Ken. Make that 4-step inventory. Do that 5th step with Ken or with me. Make those decisions in the 7th step. Pray the 7th step prayer. Make that 8th step list. Begin making those 9th step amends. So you can live to good order and be of maximum service to God and to your fellow man in 10, 11, and 12. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. I got out of the hospital on Christmas Day. Best Christmas I'd ever had up to that point. The following Christmas, my wife and I reconciled. And she and I have been together ever since. In this past August, we celebrated 43 years of marriage. And if she were here, you might want to give her a chip for that. She's been married the entire 43 years. As you've heard, I've had time off for bad behavior. So I began this journey. But I had this anger at God, and I'd expressed it to Ken and Bob before, and Bob said, after all that God has done for you, Jack, what is this with anger at God? And I said, well, when I was 14 years old, I had prayed that my father would stop drinking, and one night he and I had a long discussion about his drinking, and he said he would stop. And that night when Mom and my sister came home, I met him at the door and I told him our problems were over. That Dad and I had had a discussion and he had agreed not to drink. And joy reigned supreme in our house that night. And this was an answer to prayer for sure. And my mom had been praying. My sister had been praying. I had been praying. The next day Dad got drunk. And I closed the door on God. I didn't want to have anything to do with a God that played fast and loose with prayers. Maybe I was inadequate. Maybe my prayers weren't adequate. Bob said, "Tell me about the God of your understanding, Jack." And I said, "The God that I understand is an old guy sitting on a throne on high with long hair and a beard. He has on an ermine cape, and he's got a clipboard and a Sharpie. And he's making marks, black marks, against my name. And he's a wrathful, vengeful, punishing God. And I don't have anything to do with him." He said, "What kind of God would you like, Jack?" I said, "I'd like to have a loving, gracious, caring, forgiving God that wants only the best for me." He said, "You can have that God, Jack, if you'll just take certain steps." He said, "How old was your dad when he stopped, or how old were you when your dad stopped drinking?" I said, "I was 26. He said, "Let's see, you prayed that your dad would stop drinking when you were 14. He stopped when you were 26. He said, "Jack, do you have any idea what 12 years means to infinite God?" Well, it had never really come up. He said, 12 years, Jack, to infinite God is an infinitesimal period of time. It's a nanoseconds. It's just an eye wink. It's nothing to God." He said, "You got pretty quick service. What are you complaining about?" Good to have a sponsor. I don't think I'd have come up with that either. You know, in our big book, it says that alcohol is not my problem. You know, if alcohol was my problem when I got out of that hospital in Johns Hopkins, I would have lived happily ever after. But I did live happily ever after. In the big book, it says the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. Well, I don't know what you do in your mind, but all I do is think. Think. I think about last week, last month, last year, 10 years. I think about next week, next month, next year. Think. I'm just glad I don't have a speaker in my forehead up here tonight, so you can hear all the thoughts that have gone through my mind in the time I've been up here. Think. I mean, there's simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. I think the book says that. My experience confirms it. There's something wrong with the way I think. The big book seems to indicate that if I will change my behaviors by following the directions of the program of recovery, I will be able to my thinking will change. If I'll follow the directions, live my way into right thinking. But I can't think my way into right living. And I have a warehouse full of evidence that that's true. A warehouse full of evidence. Nobody ever comes to AA on a winning streak. If you came to AA on a winning streak, please see me after the meeting. I'd like to hear about it. I come here because it's the last house on the block. I want to stop hurting. The emotional upset, I can't take it anymore. I mean, I'm a circuit court judge, and they're asking me to solve other people's problems. I can't solve my own problems. This is a hard, hard way to live, not drinking and not changing. It's kind of like don't drink and go to meetings. I hope you don't tell people that here. You know, people die because they believe us. When we say don't drink and go to meetings, they think that's all they have to do is don't drink and go to meetings. Now, if you say something like don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, get a big book, read the book, do the program. Now that works. We all know that works. But don't drink and go to meetings. I don't do well with that. Because I'm on my own then. I haven't changed a bit. And it says in the book, if the alcoholic doesn't change, if there isn't a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism, I'm doomed. That the alcoholism is fatal for me. That it has the power to kill. That's not very encouraging. What do they mean by that? They mean, Jack, bend over, grab your ankles, and kiss your ass goodbye, because you don't have a chance. Absent a spiritual awakening. So I began to take the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, and wonderful, wonderful things came true for me. Incredible experiences. It says in the big book that if we make sure that our relationship with God is right, great experiences, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. For me and countless others. I've had so many great events come to pass in my life, it's very, very difficult to even begin to mention them. But here's a great event that came to pass for me. I went out to Akron for Founders Day. And if you've been to Akron, you know you can get the package where you stay in the dorm rooms and you eat in the dining hall. And on Saturday you get breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then on Sunday you get breakfast. And they got all these buffet lines, and then they tell you where to sit. You don't have a choice about this. You sit where they tell you. They got really bossy ladies there who tell you where to sit. So you go down this long line of chairs, every chair, every chair, every chair, every chair, and now they're coming down the other side, every chair, every chair, every chair. And somebody new sits across from you at every meal. And so I had done that Saturday for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and my friend Glenn and I, we'd had a great time, met some wonderful people. And Sunday morning I went up to the men's room there in the dormitory, and a guy comes in and he says, "Hi, I'm Woody from Baltimore." And I said, "Well, hi, I'm Jack from Hagerstown." And he said, "Wow, I come up to Hagerstown all the time." I said, I thought he was a truck driver. I said, "What brings you to Hagerstown, Woody?" He says, "Me and my sponsor, we bring a meeting up to that prison in Hagerstown once a month." I said, "Woody, I'm embarrassed to talk to you." I said, I live 10 miles from that prison. I don't know a single person that takes a meeting in there." He said, "Would you like to go with us?" "Woody, I'd really like to talk to you about that, but I got to meet my friend Glenn here. He's waiting for me, so maybe we can talk about it a little bit later." And I skedaddled out of there, and I went back to our room, and I met Glenn, and I told him what had happened. He said, "You give me your telephone number." I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Jack, there's 15,000 people here this weekend. He'll never find you." And I took comfort in that. So we went over to the dining hall and got in line and went through the buffet line and went into the dining place, and there, yep, I got to go down this line, got to sit every chair, every chair, every chair, every chair, every chair, every chair, every chair. Okay, now they're coming down the other side, every chair, filling every chair, filling every chair, filling every chair. I wonder who's going to sit across from me. "Woody, not over there, not over here. Right here, directly in front of me." And he says to the guy who is his sponsor, "That's the guy. That's the guy that wants to take meetings into prisons." I don't think I have to convince you that as a retired circuit court judge, I am not interested in taking meetings into prisons. But God doesn't care. God does not care. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that this whole thing is about getting me to do stuff I don't want to do. I mean, in the book it says, most of us don't want to do this, and that most of us don't want to do this. But it's necessary for the process to work. And so I started taking meetings into prisons. First meeting I took into the prison was chaired by a guy I'd put into prison. He hadn't done a fourth step, and he really was, resentments were really causing him some difficulty, and kind of disrupted that meeting that night, I'll tell you. And second meeting I went to in the prison, the guy sitting next to me, I'd put him in prison too, but he'd gotten paroled, and then he put his own self back into prison. So he wasn't nearly as upset with me as he was with himself. And I continued to take meetings into prisons till our local prison administration determined that AA was not an effective treatment modality. and they got themselves $1.5 million grant to do some cognitive restructuring. Now our new commissioner of correction is wondering why they gave up a program that was free and seemed to be working for a program that cost $1.5 million and hadn't produced any results. So maybe they'll figure it out. I don't know. In the meantime, we stand ready to go back to the jails if asked. I was telling somebody earlier today, it was really, 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 really cold in Hagerstown, and I saw an ad in a legal paper that said, be a lawyer in paradise, and the Republic of Palau was looking for assistance attorneys general, and so I fired off a resume and went home, and my wife said, anything interesting happen at work this week or today? And I said, nope. I did apply for a job in the Republic of Palau, and she said, well, where's that? And I said, I don't know where it is, honey, but I said, it's got to be warmer than it is here. And she got out an atlas and a magnifying glass, and I would encourage you to get a magnifying glass if you're going to go looking. But it's an island nation out in the Western Pacific, and to make a long story short, after a whole series of God shots, I mean a lot of God shots, I got named the Attorney General of this country. Country. Not a possession. Not a trust territory. My own country. So I called New York and I said, do we have any meetings out in the Republic of Palau? And they said, no, we don't. Got them in Guam, but that's 2 hours by jet. That's beyond any lengths. But the Republic of Palau are the second highest per capita consumers of Anheuser-Busch products in the world. So it seemed to be fertile ground. So they sent me a starter kit. Everything you need to start a meeting in a small town or a small country. And so I went out to Palau, and somebody said to me out there, said, hey, you know, there's a guy from Annapolis, Maryland out here. You ought to call him up. He does photography, and he works up at the National Hospital with the folks that got alcohol and drug problems. So my first telephone call as the Attorney General of this country, I made to Bill Periclear, and he answered the phone, and I asked him if he was a friend of Bill W.'s, and he said he was. And I asked him if there were meetings in Palau, and he said there were, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays up at the National Hospital. I said, you didn't tell New York. He said, I didn't know I had to tell New York. I said, well, you don't really have to tell them, but they are kind of interested in this stuff. And he said, well, why don't you come up to the meeting tonight? And I said, I'll be there. He said, it's on the breezeway between the lockdown ward of the mental health wing and the morgue. What better place for an AA meeting? So, you know, when you're going to a meeting for the first time, you like to make a good impression. So I got all my AA t-shirts out and laid them on my bed. I got a black t-shirt that says First Things First on it. You don't wear black in a tropical climate. I think we all know that. I got no idea why I even packed this black t-shirt. So I just put that over the side. I'm looking at my white shirts. My First Things First shirts. My Happy, Joyous, and Free shirt. My Let Go and Let God shirt. But over here, this little black shirt's going, wear me, wear me, wear me. If you ever had that voice going on in your head, you know the only way to shut it up is do whatever it says. So I put on that black shirt that said First Things First, and I drove up to the National Hospital, and I found that meeting on the breezeway between the lockdown ward of the mental health unit and the morgue. And there were two Americans there and three Palauans, and he welcomed me to the First Things First group of Palau. And Mary said, how did you know to wear that shirt? I said, Mary, I didn't know. And I love it when God does a bank shot just to show off. Just to let me know that no matter what I may be thinking, moved halfway around the world to this little island nation, and I'm thinking maybe this is crazy. And God's saying, no, Jack, you're right where I want you to be. Right here, right now. I stand before you tonight as the deposed Attorney General for the Republic of Palau. My wife and I were thrown out of the country. I arrested the Deputy Chief of the National Police Force, charged him with a number of alcohol and methamphetamine offenses. I think I would have survived that, but About 10 days later, I arrested my immediate superior, the Minister of Justice, and charged him with conspiracy to traffic in drugs and obstruction of justice. And he, like the deputy chief, was a lifelong friend of the president and personal appointee to the position. And so they made us an offer we couldn't refuse. And the longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, it becomes apparent to me the less I know. But I do know this. I know that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody prayed. Actually, I think a lot of somebody's prayed. I know my wife prayed. I know our children prayed. I know my mom, who doesn't think I'm alcoholic, she just thinks I'm crazy. Please, God, send somebody to help my son, Jack. Somebody prayed. If you're here tonight and you're alcoholic, you're here because somebody prayed. Maybe a lot of somebody's prayed. Maybe you prayed that alcoholic prayer, God, please help me. Maybe your mom or your dad or your brother or your sister or your wife or your husband, maybe your children, somebody prayed. And you may not like that. You may not even believe it, and really I don't care. Because it's just truth. And that's the problem with the truth. Truth doesn't care whether I like it or not. Doesn't care whether I believe it or not. Truth is just truth. That's it. That's the truth. Now here's something that's true. I think I can say this without getting any argument from anybody. And that is, the people who are sitting in this room, right here, right now, have never been assembled together in the history of the world. And we are never, ever going to be assembled together again. And our book says, there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here. Right now. There's somebody in this room who had absolutely no intention of being here tonight. And yet you're here. No denying that. You're here. There's some other folks who are here who were sent here to hear something, and I don't know what you were sent here to hear, and I don't know why you were sent to hear it. Maybe it was for you. Maybe it's for somebody you sponsor. Maybe it's for that new sponsee that God's preparing for you, who's going to send around Thanksgiving. I don't know. But you were sent here to hear something. I mean, think of all the twists and turns that your life had to take to bring you to this point in time. Right here, right now. And think of all the twists and turns that my life had to take to bring me here to this room at this point in time. We are not here by accident. This is not a coincidence. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. We've got a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that everybody here has got a copy of this. I hope every one of you have read it. Somehow, the looks on your faces, I see that you're seeing it for the first time. I would encourage you to get a supply of these. Give them to your sponsees. Make sure your home group has them. I think it's the finest piece of AA literature we have outside of the big book. Now, that's my opinion. If you've read this pamphlet, you have your own opinion. You don't have to share it with me. If you haven't read this pamphlet, you don't have an opinion. So why don't you get a copy and read it? But here's what it says at the very end. Tomorrow, Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. The poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burn with an inner hunger and an inner thirst. And that the word gospel meant, quite literally, the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. If they were here this evening and they were to ask me, "Jack, tell us, what did you find?" I would have to say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and what I have seen. The blind do see. The lame do walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead rise. And over again in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. As my friend Ed was so fond of saying, I love each and every one of you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Thanks for letting me share.